Welcome to the second session, the afternoon of OSCOM. We're here with a panel of wonderful experts, some lawyers, some non-lawyers, and we're hoping to delve into intellectual property and open source, the types of protections that one might use from the law and otherwise to protect open source, and what the rights and responsibilities related with those protections are. I realize I'm also here with the representing the Berkman Center CAP. I'm John Palfrey, Executive Director of Berkman Center. For those of you who weren't here before, welcome and thank you for coming to OSCOM. I have one brief network update, which is we're working hard on getting net connection, but and there was some progress in between then and now, but it's still not done. We'll just keep you posted, but my guess is this is something we actually will be able to solve with a, but it's a university level thing, so
late
working
Friday
on it.
Then.
I'm sorry?
Late Friday then.
Late Friday, right, right. Well, we'll see. Hopefully sooner than that. So I want to use very much the same model as the morning session that Charlie Nesson did on can you make money on open source for this legal panel. We'll continue some of the themes that were developed there, but also mainly want to recreate the spirit. I thought this was a great audience. This was one of the more informed audiences I've ever heard with, on a topic like this. So keep firing the questions. As Dave Weiner says, if you do not interrupt us with questions, we will bore you. So take that on yourself. Not speaking for you guys. I'm sure you'll be brilliant and quite entertaining. But to wit, we want to keep this snappy. I'll do a quick set of introductions, and then each of the panelists are going to help us get a sense first of what the range of protections are, the kinds of things people can do within the intellectual property realm to protect your open source, if that's what you want to do. And then we'll get into some of the issues associated with that. Larry Rosen is a senior lawyer, somebody who has been in this space for a long time. Open Source Initiative is something he has been deeply involved in as Secretary and General Counsel and has drafted lots of the licenses that many of you have used from time to time and has some very good, strong feelings on this front. Aaron Swartz, one of the wunderkind of the internet law space, not yet a lawyer, but will be shortly, I'm sure, is here representing Creative Commons, one of the things near and dear to our heart at the Berkman Center. We'll talk about some what you might consider unconventional licenses for this purpose, but how they fit in to this story. Lisa Vertinsky is a lawyer, graduate of this law school, somebody who studied with Terry Fisher, who's an intellectual property professor here, a colleague of Jonathan Zittrain's from his time here, and is a PhD economist, and is now a lawyer at Wolf Greenfield in Boston, working on intellectual property matters, and will hopefully focus on some of the pitfalls that you might face in this space. And then we have Mike Olson, who is our not representing a legal interest, but rather the CEO of Sleepy Cat Software, which has dealt with some of these novel issues in his own way and has a particularly unconventional take on the GPL, which we're eager to tease out. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Larry Rosen and have him give us a sense of what some of the options are for a developer in this space.
Thank you. I wasn't quite sure how to prepare for this presentation because the questions that I saw in the emails that preceded my participation in this seemed to indicate that there was a fair amount of confusion about what open source licenses do, and so I wasn't sure if I needed to start by describing a little bit about what those licenses are intended to be about. There are lots of open source licenses now. Most of them will never have much impact. Obviously, the GPL is the major one, but there's also the Mozilla license. There's also the BSD license, the MIT license, and a whole bunch more that are what I would call the corporate ego licenses, IBM, Nokia, Apple, Sun, and a variety of other companies have developed open source licenses. And just to confuse things, I wrote a bunch too. So there's a lot of licenses out there and a lot of confusion about what they mean for the most part. If the license is OSI approved, the bottom line is this. If you're a company that intends merely to use the software, don't worry about it. Doesn't matter which license you're using. The only impact is if you intend to make modifications to the software and distribute those modifications, and then you may need to be a little bit cautious about which license you're using. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't things that you ought to read carefully in each license. For example, if you let me back up for a second. A license, except possibly the GPL, and we could go on for a while about that one, is a contract between two parties. And so the issue is, what happens if there is dissatisfaction down the road, unhappiness that may result in some sort of litigation? That's the only time you really have to be concerned about it. And if it's an open source license, the question is, can the licensor sue the licensee for failure to abide by the terms of the license? And if you are a licensee who's in a company that's merely going to use software, nothing they can sue you about. The open source definition ensures that you have the right to copy and modify and use it internally for any purpose you want. So there is no basis for which a licensor is ever going to sue a licensee within a company. Now, what about the licensee suing the licensor? Well, suppose the software is crap. Suppose it's worse than crap. Suppose it's harmful. Then there is a possibility that the licensee will want to sue the licensor for delivering crap instead of good open source software, in which case you need to read the license to make sure that you know where you can sue and in what venue and whether warranties have been disclaimed and things of that sort. But for the most part, if you're willing to take the risk and accept software and use it internally in your company, don't worry about what license it is. Now, if you're going to be a software vendor and you're going to be either modifying and distributing modifications, then you do have to pay more attention to the license, and then it does make a difference whether it's a BSD-style license or what I would call the academic-style licenses, or whether it's a license that contains the reciprocity provision. Let me address two questions that showed up in the emails that I got and just make sure that there are no open issues about that here among the crowd. First of all, can you charge for open source software? And the answer is you can charge anything you want. Anyone who receives open source software can turn around, make copies of it, and sell it to anyone he wants. Now, you're going to get people to buy? Not if their neighbor down the street can make a free copy for them. So there are market forces that determine what the price of software is, but the open source definition does not prohibit anyone from selling software. So sell it if you want. Sell it as a package with services, or sell it simply because you're Red Hat and people want to buy it in the store because they like your brand name. No, there's no restrictions in the open source definition. Now, some of you may have been trying to read OSD provision number one, which says that in terrible words, and I've been trying to get the Open Source Initiative Board to try to rethink how to word OSD number one to make clear what I just said, which is you're free to charge anything you want. The other point about charging for software is that when you do give or sell open source software to your customer, the one thing you can't do is require your customer to pay you royalties for copies that they make. They are free to make all the copies they want, and they're free to distribute those copies, and in fact, they're free to sell those copies. Okay? There's nothing in the open source definition that prevents that. And the third point I want to make just really briefly is with respect to dual licensing. If you are the author of software, you are the copyright holder, you can do anything you want or any combination of things that you want with that software. I can sell it to Denise and give it away free to Dave, assuming that Denise is willing to pay me and not go off to Dave and try to get him to make a free copy. The licensor, the owner of the right to license software, is free to distribute it under as many licenses as he wants.
Great. This is something we'll pick up on, actually, a number of things that Larry's put here, because I think he's gone directly at some of the key questions that people had raised coming with this, but I want to get some more on the table. Aaron, tell us about Creative Commons.
Okay, so I'm from Creative Commons, which is an organization designed to provide a variety of licenses for people who have creative things that they want to make available to people. So you come to our website, you plug in a you fill out a little form that asks you questions. Do you want attribution? Do you want people who modify your work to share it alike? And so on. And then it gives you the license that our lawyers have put together that enforces those restrictions. So we've got licenses going all the way from the very basic, from public domain, which says this work is no copyright at all, you could do whatever you want, which some open source software is licensed under, going all the way to a more restrictive thing, which says all you can do is make copies of it, you can't modify it, and you have to give me credit every time you use it. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to put these variety of licenses out there so that people can use the license and find it easily and use the one that they want. So we're basically building these tools. We don't have much of a philosophy, unlike some other organizations. So just to have some fun philosophy, I thought I'd channel our president, Larry Lessig, who's got some interesting opinions and feels that commercial software should be required to include source code to get a copyright. So one of the misconceptions I wanted to address is just giving away your source code means that you've agreed to an open source license. If you give away your source code, there are some things under the copyright law that the person is allowed to do. They're allowed to use it, they're allowed to modify it and use the result, but they can't distribute it to someone else. So if you have a commercial product, you're free to include source code with it, and it can help your users, but it's not going to destroy your whole business. Just because they have the source code, it doesn't mean they're any more likely to make copies for their friend than if they didn't have the source code. It's easy for them in both ways. So that's Lessig's point of view. Stallman's point of view is that software should be free, and all software should be open source, and what he likes to call free software. And so there's also been a sort of conflict between open source and free software. And I like to explain it like this. It's like the conflict between Democrats and Republicans. They both believe that government should be, you know, should be democratically elected, but they want that for different reasons. Free software feels that software should be free so that people have the freedom to do what they want, whereas open source feels it should be free because they think that's going to be a better business decision or because they think that makes it more useful or it helps them out. So with that bit of philosophy and practical advice, I guess that's what I'm going to be representing here.
Sounds good. Lisa.
I think that one thing that's interesting to think about is that you need intellectual property rights to create an open source community. And initially, I know with the sort of the free software movement, the thought was to reject ownership rights, and it turned out to be a bit of a problem because people would take this freely available public domain information and they would create proprietary rights and walls around it. So we start off needing to understand what these intellectual property rights are and what we can do with them in order to understand how they work in an open source community. You've got copyright, which protects the tangible expression of ideas. You have patents, which protect the functionality of things. Trade secrets, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So you start with these different sort of clusters of rights. A license allows you to carve up and allocate these rights in any way you want. So I think sometimes discussions in the open source context tend to go in circles because we start talking about the licenses instead of what the objectives are. And whenever I'm looking at a license, I have to first understand what the person wants to do with it, and then you look at sort of the written agreement that's going to take you there. And I think it's interesting to look at what happened with the efforts to standardize open source definitions and to try and create a framework for standardizing open source licenses. The result was a proliferation of different kinds of licenses, all of which satisfied four basic criteria in the OSI definition, for example. Then you had about 30 licenses that satisfy those criteria, and they all do very different things. And so I think this is sort of, this panel is a better format for this panel as a question and answer format, because you have to start ultimately with what the objective is and then understand which of these licenses will get you there and what the implications of using them are.
Great. I think that's a perfect lead into our last panelists. Mike Olson has a very specific set of business requirements that he brought to this, and he had to navigate his way through what were at least 30 choices, certainly more than that, and he's taken a 31st path, as I understand it.
Yeah, this, daily we have to make that navigation. So just to let you know who I am, I'm the CEO of Sleepy Cat. My background is I'm an engineer by training. I have a master's degree in computer science from Berkeley. I do sales and marketing for my company. I'm here today to speak to you about legal issues. So I'm either a dilettante or very broad. I want to hit on a couple of points that I think are important relative to this conversation. First, I want to explain what we do. We distribute BerkeleyDB. It's an embedded data manager that all of you will touch this week in your navigation of the web and your reading email. It's embedded in lots and lots of applications and services and devices that you use. We use a dual licensing strategy to distribute our product. So there is an open source license, which permits you to do a bunch of desirable and useful stuff for free, and prohibits you from doing something that lots of companies want to do. Those companies can come to us and buy a different license. That's how we fund our business. The open source distribution gives us an enormous market presence and a very large installed base. The proprietary licensing gives us a good revenue stream that we can use to invest in the product. In setting up our business, we had to pay careful attention to the relationship among the license and what it says, the technology and how it works and how it's used by users, since what the license governs is what people can do with the technology. You have to pay attention to what they want to do with that software if you want to make the third part, the business model, specifically a revenue stream, work. We think that we've got that all balanced out well for Sleepy Cat. The company's doing quite well. As a practical guy running a business every day, not as a lawyer, I speak to our attorney regularly about the things we need to pay attention to. One of the important points to raise is that we, like everyone else, like Microsoft, like IBM, rely on the strength of intellectual property law to give us the rights to do what we want to do under open source distribution. So IP law is really fundamental to open source and to proprietary distribution of software. Another important thing for you to consider if you want to distribute open source as a business is that under American case law, you have an obligation to protect your intellectual property. So if you release something under a license and you're aware of massive violation of those license terms, according to our attorney, there is at least some case to be made for the fact that you've surrendered those protections. So if you want to distribute software under an open source license, you need to think about how you might respond to violators of that license and how you would pursue them. If you're a company with a revenue stream, you can employ lawyers to threaten them, and that works well. If you're not, you might think about an affiliation with an organization like Creative Commons or FSF that's around to guarantee that those rights are observed. Actually, I've got a few more points, but I think I'll wait for them to come out during questioning, since that'll be a better use of the time.
Sounds great. All right, we'll start with a question back here. Then I want to get back also to Charlie Nesson's hypo from the first part.
First, a meta question. So far, everyone's talked about IP and open source licenses for software. Now, this is OSCOM, which is a meeting about content management systems. Obviously, the content that goes into these systems also is intellectual property, and it can have licenses applied to it. And I know, for example, the Creative Commons licenses actually maybe fit that mold better than fitting them to software. Any comments from the panelists about content management and IP?
Yes, please tell us who you are.
I'm Ross Reedstrom. I'm with the Connections Project at Rice University, and I'm speaking this track on Friday morning, actually.
Let me comment about that, because I thought Aaron introduced that a little bit when he was talking about the Creative Commons licenses. Software is different from a book or music. And the courts and the legislature have struggled for many years to try to understand those differences, and I think what they've done, quite frankly, is confused the topic by allowing software both to be copyrighted and patented
and trade secreted.
And
that license, right?
Well, yes, and licensed through contract. And it makes it very complicated to try to decide. If you have something that is just content, whatever that means, just content, then the Creative Commons licenses work beautifully for that. But if you have something that is not just content, but also intends to be used, then you have to deal with things like patent, which deals with use. So you have to have provisions in the license that deal with granting or not granting certain patent licenses. You have to deal with things like source code, which, what is source code for music? I'm not quite sure. The other confusing aspect to it is that technology is changing, so now it's awfully difficult to determine whether what you're dealing with is content or software. You have a CD that has, or DVD that has a movie on it, and that movie includes some software on the disc. The Creative Commons licenses do not address those problems.
Aaron, what do you say? Yeah, so we've been careful to say that Creative Commons licenses are not really intended for software, because we haven't looked at the issues of software. Software is different, as Larry's explained. And so, you know, if you really care about it, you might not want to license your software under a Creative Commons license, because our lawyers haven't checked it out. They haven't considered all the possibilities. But definitely for content, we think that's really, you know, a much different subject. We think that for content, there's a, you know, a much broader range of things for people to choose that makes sense for them. You know, your music, if you're just writing it by yourself, you might want to let people modify it. Whereas with software, you know, there are a whole bunch of different choices you can make. So
great. I think this is a very helpful distinction, which is to say I'm talking about content management systems, and there are lots of different intellectual property protections that could work for different things. Software is certainly one main category, but content that may be governed wrapped into any number of things with that code might well be licensed under something separate.
I just wanted to make one very brief point, and that is that a good example of this right now is bioinformatics and biotechnology. There's a great deal of information being produced at taxpayer expense here in the U.S. that's required by law to be distributed to whoever wants it, and that's a good thing. I don't think that you can entirely divorce that from the question of the software you use to manage it. However, you know, if the publicly available data is only available in a proprietary database format, what good is that? So the two issues do relate to one another.
Great. I think this is a helpful thing. Dave, you got 1 second?
Yes, I want to touch on something that Larry was saying.
Do you have the mic for that?
I wanted to speak. Can I go and I'll hand it to Dave? Okay.
I'll make it really quick. Larry, you touched on something that I think is really important.
I assume I'm coming over here.
This is something that whenever this subject comes up and I'm in the room with a lawyer, I try to bend their ear on this one. When you say, I totally agree that the lines between software and writing or all kinds of creativity are just getting harder and harder to find. And when we talk about patents, I think that, you know, along with, I think most of the people in this room, if they believe in open source, also believe that software patents are generally a bad thing. And my feeling is that at some point we're going to get a chance to crack those patents by using the fact that First Amendment protects the expression, the verbal expression, even though there's no equivalent thing for software. And so it's something to watch out for. I think that perhaps patents can be completely, you know, whatever, done away with because of that.
That sounds very interesting and intriguing. Joseph, what do you got?
So my name is Joseph Riegel. I work at MIT, and I work for the W3C, and I maintain both our document and our software license. And I wanted, since I have the opportunity maybe to get some free legal advice, I wanted to put a question to you guys that I've been thinking about recently, and it does relate to this question of the difference between software and documents, in that HTML has a set of tags associated with it, H1, P. The W3C has standardized a technology called XML, which allows everyone to create different vocabularies for their own applications in a definition called a DTD or a schema. So sometimes I get the question that are DTDs and schemas copyrightable? I read two law journals recently on it. I didn't think they shed that much light on it. We've always said that our DTDs and schemas are copyrightable. We treat we release our DTDs and schemas under our software license, which is OSI approved open source license, which means that people can make derivations, but there's some tricky issues with respect to, you know, typically if you have a vocabulary set, there's some identifier associated with it. There's a doc type or a namespace. What we do say is if you take, say, the HTML vocabulary and you change it, you have to use a different identifier. But the question I actually wanted to raise was, is it conceivable, say I'm using a content management program, and they have a vocabulary, and with a bunch of tags that they've come up with for storing my content, is it conceivable, if their DTD for their vocabulary is copyrightable, that my content would be subject to their copyright? In that when I take the tags they defined, filled it in with content, I was creating a derivative work of their copyrightable DTD. So.
I think we should go with the open source people. No,
I'm kidding.
I mean, I'm not fully sure I understand the sort of the mechanics. One thing you have to watch out for is with some content management systems, you're dealing with things that are functional. Those, and the functionality of something isn't protectable by copyright. That's something that may or may not be protectable by patent, but it's not covered by copyright. And the old example is, in copyright laws, a form, they had double, different kinds of counting books. And could you protect with copyright the way that you developed sort of bookkeeping? And the answer to that was no, because that's functional. The only way you can keep your accounts is with this kind of bookkeeping system. And I think that's the kind of analysis that you would end up, that very sort of old school analysis of can you protect forms books, you'd end up applying that to analyze the new technology. It's really funny how you, the same examples or the same analysis that worked 30 years ago tends to work with the new technology.
Councilor Rosen, how do you see it?
I think it's a very complicated area of the law to try to distinguish between the copyrightable portion of a work and the patentable portion of a work.
Two law review articles, by the way.
Well, at least two, and there are many other. My problem is, as an advocate for open source, I am very concerned at companies attempting to protect by implying patent law terminology to protect copyrightable subject matter and vice versa. I think people, lay people confuse it all the time, and companies purposely confuse it.
Oh, I thought I was here to ask a question. Oh, to answer it, I don't know. I guess maybe the Teddy Ruxpin case, which is one of my favorite intellectual property cases of all time, would provide some answer, which is that the actual copyrightable derivative work was Teddy Ruxpin. This is where you put the cassette into the tummy of the bear, and it tells you a story and moves around according to little signals inside the cassette. And a third party started doing bootleg Teddy Ruxpin cassettes with like stories not approved by Teddy Ruxpin Inc. In fact, recently at the Illegal Art Festival, they had him doing William S. Burroughs. They called it William S. Barrows. Sure enough, that third-party company was sued successfully in federal court because of contributory copyright infringement. They were assisting little kids in the copyright infringement that the little kids were doing when they innocently stuck the bootleg cassette into the Teddy Ruxpin and made an audio-visual work of muling teddy bear with story that was infringing. So, I don't know, Joe, I guess you'd probably want to draft things such that your XML tags, nobody later, if some executive director of your organization was evil, could try to claim that anything done with XML was, you know... Yeah, I wouldn't ask that question too loudly, you know.
I think the lesson to be learned from that case is that even the courts can get it wrong, and that it is important for us to make the right arguments at the right time before the right court to make sure that that kind of result doesn't happen for software.
Yeah, there was certainly a period of time, though, I think, when Microsoft, for instance, in their licensing agreement for Visual Basic, said that anything you write using Visual Basic is a derivative work, and, you know, they claim it. Fat lot of good, since it's Visual Basic. I had a question, now that you mention it. I've been trying, with very mixed success, to follow this SCO case against... IBM without trying to make it into like my life's work, which you appear to have to do to understand it. But it raised for me kind of the upper level question I'm interested to know what our panel thinks of. And that is, strangely enough, we might see proprietary software makers offering now as a feature of their software that it's freer than open source. Freer in the sense that it is unencumbered by the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that comes if you should dare to take something that purports to be under a GNU license. There have been 1,000 cooks around the soup. God knows if one day one of them should say, you know what, I actually didn't mean to do that, or I never did give permission. And they basically say, it's like, you know, you don't know where this software's been, why would you want it interacting with your machine? And this is now a legal issue rather than, oh, it might have viruses. So I'm wondering if, I mean, this might be replicated in the content realm too, Creative Commons shying away from hosting a library of work under the Creative Commons license for exactly this sphere. Are there any solutions we can think of so as not to actually have this odd result of proprietary software seeming safer and freer than open software?
Before anyone answers that, just to make clear, this may be a fact for the unmarried child. Mr. Jones, professor here at law, I've heard law school, I don't think he's with
those. I mean, I'll suddenly do like, nah, huh, well then do you think? Yeah, no, I, yeah. Okay, no, I'm curious.
Do you represent SCU?
Oh yeah, let's lead the lamb to the slaughter here. I'm going to answer a legal question from a lawyer, from a law professor at Harvard.
Uh-huh.
I want to say two things. First, I'm like you. I'm following this case kind of in my spare time with great interest. It reminds me of, I don't know if you followed the original AT&T lawsuit against the University of California, Berkeley. One of Sleepy Cat's founders, Keith Bostick, was personally named in that suit, and he's the only guy I know ever to have been sued by the phone company. There was a really interesting legal definition created during that time, which was mentally contaminated. You had looked at source code that infected you somehow, and anything you produced later would
right.
be infected.
Right.
As a practical matter, if I just sort of look at all of the businesses at play here, I can't imagine that SCO is going to prevail in its business objective of generating revenues. What's going to happen in the legal system, I don't know, but if it gets threatening enough, somebody will buy the company and kill everyone.
Yeah.
Is there a way to protect against proprietary vendors' software seeming somehow safer and better than open source content or software? Was, I think, your level zero question. I think that's happening, and it's not really because of little guys like me, but because of big guys like IBM and Sun and Hewlett-Packard getting on that bandwagon and putting their muscle behind it. I can tell you that 4 years ago, it was very hard for us to sell open source software. It's hard to explain, first, what it was, second, why in the world you would pay for it, and then third, if you're going to pay somebody, why you'd pick, you know, 5 long-haired guys from Berkeley to pay. That problem has gone away as our business got bigger, but also as the market got smarter about open source software. And I think that the participation of big vendors in the space eliminates an enormous amount of that fear, uncertainty, and doubt. You don't hear anybody from Redmond talking about cancer and un-American communist software anywhere. Those arguments...
No, you just see them taking SCO software and saying, aha, we're going to cut a licensing deal with SCO now.
You know, it's $1 million bet on the come for Microsoft. It's in the noise. It's below the audit risk for the company. And, maybe it'll work, you know?
Right.
No, I thought that was an interesting play by those guys, but I don't think it's significant in any way.
Uh-huh.
I think that one thing that the case illustrates, and actually I think that the discussion this morning illustrated as well, is that open source means different things to different people. For some, it's a development environment, and that means certain things that you need open source to do. For some, it's a marketing strategy. And in this particular case, there's a lot of dynamics that we probably only partly understand between Microsoft and IBM and SCO and some others, and they are using this as a strategic gain. And so Microsoft is now entering into negotiations to get patent rights. Is that to get back at IBM, or is that for some other business reason? What's interesting is in the last couple of weeks, you've seen in the New York Times, for example, in the business sections, articles about open source. And they're different. Some are on that case. Some are about using open source in the nonprofit world. but I think that the prevalence of discussion about open source is new and kind of indicates that it is shifting more into this business strategy realm, into the big player realm.
Lisa, let's actually keep it in the business strategy realm. Someone comes to you, this Dudley Doolittle, Professor Nesson introduced in the first instance, he's somebody who has made a bunch of software that has been very successfully distributed under some form of open source license, take GPL for instance, and now wants to distribute some of it proprietary and keep some of it under this open source. We talked about how dual licensing technically is probably okay from a literal matter. But go to Jonathan's problem, which is from a business perspective, do you and your sort of counseling this business person, is there anything they should be worried about in the sense that there's a really good argument here, the proprietary software is there's freer in a sense because it's very, very clear what the rights are, whereas with GPL or any number of these 30 plus other licenses, there's a business problem because there's a lack of clarity around what your rights and responsibilities are.
I could write a proprietary license that was very confusing.
Right.
So I don't think that it's the proprietariness of the I could also do one that was very good. But
for which would
so
you
charge?
For which would you charge more?
Yeah, right, for which I would charge more. But I think I want to go back to something that I often get confused in answering these questions. A license is a tool, and a license is a way of spelling out rights and obligations. Whether you want to do that in an open source context or in a proprietary context, it's really the difficulty is in understanding the objectives, understanding who owns what at the beginning and who's going to own what at the end, and then actually drafting the license to do that. That isn't a problem. It's really with your question, it was if I'm a company and I'm using open source software, my concern is I don't know where it came from and I don't know who owns it, so I don't know what I can do to assign it to other people or to give it to other people. That's the sort of the core thing that companies that I work with struggle with.
Larry, do you have a different take on that before we go to the next question?
My feeling about the SEO lawsuit is, I think I'm paraphrasing the quotation right, it's a lot of hat and no cattle. And I don't think it's an important case. I think it's a private dispute between IBM and SEO. It's strictly a trade secret issue. I think it's going to be resolved quite simply. The best argument I heard is the one that Evan Moglen raised, which is since SEO or its predecessor had in fact distributed Linux themselves under the GPL, you can't retract that. And once they did that, it was available and available for derivative work and available for anyone to use. So I'm not worried about the suit. I think it's desperate companies do desperate things.
And you don't think there's a need for a central registry, a sort of meta source forge of code so that as open source software makes the rounds, new derivative works are created, we don't have to worry that somewhere along the way something was slipped in there, written by someone else that is not what that person wanted to have happen.
I think it is extremely important for open source projects to become better at controlling their contributions that are made to them. But I don't think that a registry of source code is going to do anyone any good any more than I've heard suggestions for prior art registries, for patents and other kinds of things. It's just a terrible waste of money and not a very effective way to fight the battle.
Yeah, Sleepy Cat, Trolltech, MySQL, Sendmail, in general, companies that make money off of these open source projects don't accept contributions without contribution of ownership as well. You have to assign ownership to get your code into the main line.
Yeah, and you just have to hope that it's yours to assign. You know, somebody, yes, I do own this.
Yeah,
you are.
Agreed. Well, yeah. That's a good point. Sleepy Cat actually doesn't take them, but...
Hi, my name is Chalu Kim, and I want to... open source companies, and I have got my troubles. And I agree with the registry of licensing. If you want to do dual licensing, maybe you could create a business transparency. Like, if you were to do proprietary, it's gonna cost you this and that. I don't know. I mean, that sounds like a good, you know, good idea. That's one of my comments. And actually, the question that I want to ask the question. I'm in the middle of a contract negotiation, and we're dealing with a large company who really cares about their content, and this is dragging out a while because they want to make sure that quote unquote their content is theirs, and some of the proprietary code that we own or we bring in from open source are owned by whoever you know created them. So now it's down to like Exhibit A, you know, any code that generates the you know client's content is yours, or like any content generated by originating from your database is yours, and it's really spelling out to be huge exhibits, and including Exhibit B that says any code that carries open source copyright such as GPL or LGPL or ZPL as in Zope content management, it's getting out to be quite big, and some 8-page contract can't explain properly of all these nuances of different copyrights. And so my question is, how would you go about simplifying this type of contract? I mean, if you have any insight, that would be helpful.
In my case, you pay me more for a shorter license.
Yeah.
Okay? Well. They're harder to write, but it's better. And I think lawyers should be expected to write clear licenses.
So, Lisa, does it need to be this complicated?
Oftentimes, I would say that the reason a license gets long is because you haven't fully worked out what the business deal is. So the reason the exhibit is long is because you
blame it on the client. Is that what it's called?
No. Actually, part of the lawyer's job is to help the client figure out what the client wants. You don't know what the rules are. You don't know, you may or you may not know how to carve things up in a way that's beneficial for you. So it's the lawyer's, it's a command job. But if you're dealing with the exhibit, figure out what it is you want to walk away owning. Or what rights you need. You may not need to own the entire copyright. You may only need to reserve certain rights to do things with it. Figure out what it is you need. Once that's clear, writing it up is generally pretty simple. And just one thing I've heard a couple of times is different kinds of copyright. There's only one kind of copyright. There's one copyright which is a cluster of different rights. It's sort of like an onion, you can peel away the layers. But there's only one kind of copyright, and how you decide to carve it up and dish it out is kind of up to you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to make a plug for copyright assignment and the way copyright assignment is handled. There are projects that use contributor agreements that set out the rights that the sponsoring body or hosting body is expecting, notably the Apache agreement. But more often, when you have dual licensing, you're looking at a copyright assignment vehicle. And the one that is used by the Free Software Foundation and picked up and used by a lot of other companies is a unilateral transfer of rights to the Free Software Foundation. I represent Sun, Dave, and work, therefore, on OpenOffice, which is dually licensed. And we got a lot of feedback from the European Union members about that copyright assignment vehicle because it's not legal in the EU to transfer your moral rights, for instance. And, of course, this was written long before the EU was created. So we drafted something called the joint copyright assignment that just the original licensor just gives a copy, confers a perfect copy of their rights, but they retain their own rights. So I'm wondering, I know Larry has strong opinions about copyright assignment generally, but you guys have been talking about dual licensing as a paradigm, and I think you have to talk about copyright assignment.
Just to clarify, I'm against them. I think they're useless. They don't do much more than granting the license to the work. They don't clarify the IP rights. They are, in fact, revocable after 35 years, just like a copyright license is. It's a false assurance of authenticity of the code and a waste of effort. But I only have weak opinions. No. I'm going to hold that to myself.
Anybody have a different view on this?
I'm interested. I'll talk with you later. We seldom, but sometimes use transfer of ownership, basically, to get contributions into the code. And in general, we sign those with reputable companies willing to stand behind, so that if there is any question about the authenticity later, we've got someone that we can go after. You know, I agree that provenance is an issue. And it's interesting to hear that you ran into a problem with the EU. That's not something that we had seen before.
So this actually gets to one of the questions that Lisa had written up in her initial foray talking to OSCOM about this conference, one of which is, what are some of the pitfalls that Dudley Doolittle or the coder who's looking to protect this IP should be thinking about? And I suspect that there's some distinction if you are thinking about a copyright assignment versus one of these licenses. And if you go back to the conversation this morning that was talking in part about Ed Kelly made the argument that if you're using the GPL, what you're really trying to do is limit your liability in an outbound sense. Talk a little bit about the liability that somebody who is taking some open source code is thinking about when they're making this decision about how to protect the code.
I guess I didn't understand. So if am I the company using open source code from someone else?
You're advising a client who is this Dudley Doolittle character. This is somebody who has developed some software, right? Presumably some of it is inbound. So yes, he's probably taking some code that's been developed by a community of people and is plausibly then passing it on through some form of licensing. What are the kinds of things that he should be worried about?
So if Dudley Doolittle has written he's written a program, and half of it he wrote, and half of it someone he met on the street contributed to him. First thing he needs to know is, well, when I got this other 50%, did I get a transfer of ownership, or did I get some license to move it forward? If all I got was a copy of it, then I'm not allowed to do anything except perhaps use it. So the first thing is, what can I do with it? What rights do I have? Then you have to wonder, well, where did it come from? Did he rip it off from someone else down the street? And so when I incorporate it into my project, am I now incorporating stuff that was misappropriated from someone else? And if so, then I'm infringing their copyright when I go forward and distribute it. Suppose then it gets put into an airplane that's it's going to be a pilotless airplane, and it crashes into a building. Well, my software, if I represented that this software worked, or if I gave any kind of representations that this software worked, I might have some responsibility later on down the road for what happened to it. This is the kind of thought process you would work through. It doesn't mean you can't control the sort of the risk. It doesn't mean you can't analyze it to gauge whether it's a real risk or not, but kind of the thought process.
Anyone else want to comment on that notion of sort of inbound stuff you're worried about in an outbound instance?
One thing on the registry idea. I know, and you probably would speak to this better, but all of the sort of a lot of the bigger companies, in fact, have a person who acts like a registry and who reviews all software that's coming in and decides whether to incorporate it in their code or not. So companies, in a sense, have their own registry.
So my name is Joseph Riegel, W3CMIT. I was going to throw another speculative question out here and see if it flies. A lot of folks in the room are probably familiar with this from the blogging world. And I guess this question is intended for Aaron, though I welcome any comment. But I remember for a while, one of the benefits of content management is obviously content repurposing. You know, you have a chunk of paragraph here, and it can go on the homepage, and then it ends up in some archive, and it ends up in a summary. And the way in the blogging world that we tend to do this, we use something called RSS, which allows you to syndicate content. Now, you often, as a author of the content, have the ability to say, I'm going to syndicate my content. There's also a lot of tools out there that scrape other people's pages that haven't been so kind to actually syndicate it. Well, I'll set a tool and it'll scrape it, and I'll be able to see what the headlines are and the latest information is. And I remember, I think it was a case of maybe Dave Weiner would know about, where some people who were blogging were surprised to see their content ending up elsewhere. And I remember there was a big stink at the time. I thought it was kind of silly and it went away. So I was wondering if anyone had any comment on the legality of scraping other people's content, because I can see why some people don't like it. They want you to go to their webpage, so you have to see the banners and the advertisements, but it makes me convenient to be able to get all my news in one client. And two, did that whole stink just go away because people's expectations changed to learn that aggregation is just a useful feature of the web and they shouldn't worry about it?
Everything on the OSI website is licensed under the open software license. Take it, use it, reprint it, copy it, modify it. Just make sure that you, when you make copies or create derivative works, don't erase our copyright notice. And I think that that's the appropriate way in an open source environment to deal with the right to reuse information.
So now, this actually, keep going.
There are other things I write. My website is not so licensed, so don't copy my stuff, but copy the OSI stuff.
Yeah, so the RSS case is really interesting. I mean, I think there's a sort of a spectrum here, right? It's almost certainly legal to write a tool that will scrape a site. It's less legal to write a tool that scrapes the site and puts the resulting RSS feed up on your web on your site, because it's obviously copyright infringement. You're duplicating all their content. Then it's probably legal to have a site that takes the RSS feed. And it may not be legal, but certainly there's sort of an implied license when you put up an RSS feed that you want stuff syndicated. There are some people who have a complaint when you put your name on it, right, because they want the right of authorship. But it's certainly, you know, the reason you have an RSS feed is so that other people can see your content in a different context. One of the things we're doing with Creative Commons is we're allowing people to put licenses inside their RSS feeds to make it extremely clear what's allowed and what's not. So you can say, I want attribution, I don't want you to put banner ads on this page, and that I hope will clear up some of the mess.
I have a comment on it, and then I'll hand to you. Well, you made a comment about it's obviously illegal to do a certain thing, obviously illegal to do another thing. I think we're talking about aggregation and abstraction, and we step into the murky waters of fair use at some point here. Because if it's copyrighted, then the fair, you know, the fourfold fair use test applies, and you can never get a lawyer to pin down for a general way to decide if something's fair use. Any individual case you can discuss. We run into this a lot in the educational world, of course, because everyone has opinions as to what they think fair use means, and everyone's wrong, of course, if you ask everyone else.
Yeah, I wasn't using any fair use arguments there.
Every lawyer has two hands. It's on the one hand and on the other hand.
And those who read science fiction then have a gripping hand as well.
Ross, can you get to Dave Weiner back there for 1 second?
I have three.
Just to the factual information about this, I mean, there were cases, there will be more. I mean, what happens is the software Radio Userland doesn't have an option to turn off the RSS feed. So basically the idea is we want people in designing the product to produce a weblog that's readable in HTML, and we wanted to promote RSS. We wanted people to produce RSS feeds. So what happened, and it's happened a few times, is a user didn't know that it was producing an RSS feed, and then saw their content aggregated on another site and said, well, my copyright's being infringed, and they get very mad, actually, some of them. And then the community explains to them what's going on. And once they understand that this is a feature of the software and it's deliberate, the problem seems to go away. But at some point, I'm sure it'll come up and the problem won't go away. The person will say, well, I now understand what it's doing and I don't like what it's doing. You know, it's kind of weird, you know, if you put your content on the web, to want to retain control of it is kind of a weird place to be. Because in a way, what you're doing when you put it on the web is you're saying, here world, have it, and I really don't want anything in return. You know, there is a copyright notice on it, but, you know, it's like what we were talking about before with open source. You know, if I give you the source code, you know, am I open source?
I'm sorry, Dave, but I got a
question. I'm not a lawyer, by the way.
No, please.
I'm just telling you as a programmer and a writer, you know.
Just because it's on the web, don't copy it.
Well,
okay, that's not
good
advice.
I understand, but you know what? How hard is it to put? Aaron did a thing called RSSify. Is that how you pronounce it? RS is, you know, that basically you put a div tag in a certain place in your template, and it can, you know, generate an RSS file. So immediately I thought, well, why don't I just teach radio how to read those files and forget about generating the RSS in the first place? Why bother, you know? And how far are we away from then repurposing your content in the aggregator without you even knowing we're doing it, you know?
Don't copy it unless you have a license for it.
I actually had something to add on this. We ran into trouble on OpenOffice in its first year from people who were subscribers to the mail list and were commenting on the mail list, but were very surprised to find that their comments on the mail list were publicly viewable and could be traced back to their domains. And we were like, don't you know about Yahoo? Right? So what we did was we strengthened the terms of use on the site, and so it was very clear these will be public documents. And I think, you know, as long as syndicators are doing that, I'm assuming Radio Userland does that. So
I actually think this points to a meta question that I think we should come back to for 1 second, which is we have struggled even at the Berkman Center thinking through this particular blogging question. If you have RSS feeds that are sent out among a community of people who are starting this new thing, blogging, say, some years ago, and everybody's sort of within the same community and they sort of have an understanding about what's going to happen with it, okay, it may technically be copyrighted, maybe you shouldn't, it's on the web, you shouldn't copy it, there's a default that basically says you create it, it's, you know, a couple little rules you have to follow, and if you put it out there, it's copyrighted. And one of the things that we worked on with some of the blogging developers and the help of Creative Commons was to work a Creative Commons license into the RSS feed itself. And that was sort of a means of saying, okay, this community is growing up, right? It's outside of this small universe of people who know what they're talking about, know what the sort of understanding is, and so we're actually going to make it a matter, in essence, of law. We're going to build a license into every single one of these feeds. So the question I actually have back for our panel, and I know there's a couple other comments on other points which we'll get to, but is, are we at some inflection point here? Is there some sense that the open source community, it could sort of work when it was a group of people who all knew one another, or all trusted one another, there wasn't a whole lot of litigation, maybe you had, you know, more than one license, but you didn't have this huge complexity. Now people are starting to make money with it, whether it's generating wealth or generating revenue, maybe it's profitable, maybe it's not, but now that things are getting a little more complicated, can this open source production model outside of a community of people know one another, can that work, or is it just going to get too complex?
Let me try to answer it this way. I said that the basic rule is that just because it's on the web, don't copy it. On the other hand, because we have two hands, if you're using it just for yourself, if you're part of the community to read it, if you're not trying to distribute it, if you're using it to try to get at the factual content as opposed to merely making copies of someone's words or expressive content, I hope there is still life in the fair use doctrine after the DMCA, and I think one ought not to approach this with so much trepidation that we hold back on exchanging information with each other. That's what this whole thing is about. So what I would caution people to do is, if you're intending to copy something for commercial purposes or widely in fora other than where it was originally submitted, look at the license before you do that.
Mike.
Hold
on a sec, Dave. Let's get these guys in for a sec.
One thought on the open source. There's a lot of discussions in different industries that have open source type sounds. In the music industry, for example, if you were to sit and listen to a panel of musicians and technologists talk, you would hear a lot of the same issues. They just maybe label them different, but open source type discussions. In agriculture, with seeds, biotech engineering, you hear open source type problems. I think that the technological advancement, the ability to copy and share, the neat things you can do with the new technology, taking people's content and creating new things, that's not going to go away, and so therefore open source is not going to go away, and people are just figuring out what the rules will be and what it really is, what really open source means.
Mike.
I just totally agree with what she said, with what Lisa said. You know, there will be pragmatic answers to what are honestly naughty questions, but open source is too useful a development and distribution model to go away. So people will figure out how to solve that. I wanted to just pop up one meta question. As I was listening to this interesting discussion to me on RSS feeds, it occurred to me that as a technologist, I can look at Google as one aggregator in the sense that you said. And it seems to me that if there's really this difficult copyright question for RSS feeds, that Google may be the test case that everybody's waiting for. And anybody who wanted to talk about that afterwards, I would be interested to hear about it.
I think just to, for, from a legal perspective, search engines tend to be classed in a slightly different place, and there's a series of other doctrinal points. But I think the point is...
They haven't been sued by the Church of Scientology yet, is
right.
What's going on.
They were threatened, though, right? Dave wants one retort, and then I will move on. Hold on. You can't capture it.
But it is, we're onto something here, because there is sort of a unified theory here, okay? Of, like, Larry, with all due respect, you're 4 years too late with this, okay? 4 years ago, there were arguments. I would take a little, I'll tell you a little experience, okay? I would see a picture on a website that I think is really interesting. I'd bring it into Photoshop, crop it, and put it adjacent to some text on my weblog. People would send me emails going, how dare you do that? How dare you take their copyrighted material? I go, well, you know, what's the harm, really, you know? Now, nobody has a problem with this. It's so meek, you know, as because we went through Napster, and we've been through, like, all this stuff.
What about my commercial software has some developer picked off a couple of lines, a couple of paragraphs of open source code? What are the ramifications of that?
Great question.
Well, that's a major revenue stream for Sleepy Cat Software. No, honestly, it's, you know, people who pick up the software and incorporate it into their commercial products is a fruitful source of business for us. I mean, so we one of the reasons we make it so available is so that people can see it, can try it out.
What percentage of that revenue do you think you capture?
It's not an enormous amount of business every year, at least in the case where it was an inadvertent inclusion of our software, where the engineer did a thing that the bosses didn't know about. Maybe a case or two a year of that. More often, it is that open source software is so easy to get, so easy to download, that by the time the ship date is coming up, it's already embedded and works well and makes the customer happy. And the switching cost at that point is so high that the guy has to sit down at the table with me. So the judo of giving him the software under what felt like very liberal conditions early on works to my advantage later.
How often do people get away without paying for it?
None of the time that we find out about. And what percentage do we find out about? Probably very little.
Anyone else on this pollution point? Awesome. We got another question over here.
My name is Butch Lazarchak. I'm from iBiblio, and we're a digital library and archive, open source, contributor-run digital library based at the University of North Carolina. And we're attempting to sort of we host a number of Linux distributions. You're probably familiar with us in that regard. And we also host what I just call intellectual content, much of which is covered by Creative Commons licenses. And we're sort of attempting to move open source software thinking into the sort of intellectual content realm. And by focusing, trying to encourage contributors who are doing collaborative projects in the kind of content realm as opposed to the software realm. And we look very closely at Creative Commons licenses, and I think they're great for what they do, though I have a question for Aaron, which is about the scalability of the licensing. For example, let's say a contributor wishes to build some sort of digital library that's going to include some content that's under copyright, and they wish to license that material from a number of different contributors, but the number of contributors is at a level above which is easily done, you know, on a one-to-one scale. So does Creative Commons have any sort of viewpoints on sort of large scale ability to license kind of stuff that's currently under copyright?
I mean, I think one thing to look at is how O'Reilly's doing it. I mean, they're going to all their authors and they're giving them this deal. They're saying, you can keep your copyright. You can keep your copyright for 20 years and then give it away. You can keep your copyright for 20 years and then go look and find a new publisher. Or you can license it under a Creative Commons license right now. And they've got they're doing this for their whole backlist. They've been going down the list, going to every author, and giving them these options. And so the hope is that we'll get a lot more books under Creative Commons licenses. And I think, you know, I think it's promising if they can do it. And I think it's very possible to license large-scale collections and make that kind of deal with a great number of authors. So you might want to talk to them, see what they're doing.
Also, Dibner has a history of science and technology project, and I think someone from iBiblio was at a conference they had. They're trying to create an online development of the history of science, and they've struggled with how to create these collaborations, how to get huge archives of documents that are copyright protected onto the web, and they've done a lot of work with universities because so basically outsourcing the problems to institutions that have already dealt with a lot of the issues. and working through it that way.
Yeah, hi, my name is Bill Kearney. I'm with syndicate.com. You know, I kind of have a meta comment about this. Expediency is no excuse for not doing diligence. And contributory licensing is an important thing to take into account if you want what's available. And what's available is the result of a process that even Charles Dickens complained about, you know, over 150 years ago. You're going to have to recognize that working within that system to change that system is the only way that you can afford to survive. So you made the comment about, is it an educational effort that's necessary? It's absolutely necessary, because there are a number of mechanisms extant in terms of copyright and other licensing methods that make all of this possible. Ignorance and assumption is like painting a target on your backside. You can't just assume because you think it's wonderful that it escapes you of any responsibility for diligence. So, you know, the more that we hear discussions about licenses, the more that people are encouraged to understand the law, the more we can work to encourage more people to provide content, to share material, and to get around the issues like Monsanto and seeds and some of the other things. There are arguably problems with those, but they developed within a framework that built all of what we have today. So, you know, the more education you guys can provide, the better.
With the proviso, the point that I made at the very beginning, which is you only need to worry about that if it is your intention to modify and distribute. If all you're going to do is use that information within your own organization, including making copies, including making modifications, and if the stuff has an open source license, an OSI certified software, help yourself. More diligence than that isn't needed.
That's true of anything that's copyrighted. You can use it and you can make modifications to it privately.
Privately.
Hard to quarrel with more education being good, though, right, Larry?
No, it's fine. Especially since we're in this august institution.
Keeps us in business.
Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Mark Rubin. I provide sales, marketing, and business development to software companies. My question has to do with some of the information that was started earlier today and was referenced in the materials. It's just to talk about dual licensing and the strategy. Again, it comes back to, okay, how do you make money in the open source area, but also where does this sit from a legality standpoint, and then it also brings in implications into, you know, the public licenses.
So refine your question, please.
Just comment on the dual licensing. I mean, is this acceptable? Is this, it's an acceptable business model, obviously, because it's being done. And then what are the implications? Because there's going to be complications down the road on this.
I'm not sure what complications you foresee. From the point of view of intellectual property law, and as participants and members in good standing of the open source community, we think that dual licensing is absolutely acceptable. It's a good thing. It gives businesses a way to survive and contribute to open source development. The legal reasoning behind our ability to do this is that we own outright the intellectual property that we're distributing. So we can give it, as was said earlier, to Denise under one license and to Dave under a much more restrictive license based on his comments today.
Precisely the same code.
Say again?
Precisely the same code.
Precisely the same code under different. Just as Microsoft can cut you and me different terms for the identical product based on who we are. Because I own the IP, I can say how I distribute it to different people. I need to be careful as a business person to be sure that my decision to release it under open source doesn't shoot in the head my desire to license it for money to someone else. So, you know, I've got something to pay attention to there. But, you know, that's just a problem I have to solve when I'm running my business.
So, Larry, to take it out of the providing legal advice to Mike down there, imagine we're back on Dudley Do-Right here. It's the guy who's got some code. He was doing it under GPL before. Now he wants to sell it. Are there any things that he particularly should be worried about if he's going to go this dual licensing route?
The only thing I would be cautious about with respect to multiple or dual licensing is your licensee suppose you license the same piece of code under the GPL and the BSD license. You're allowed to do that.
Does anybody do that?
I would think it would be foolish.
Seems strange.
Larry Wall uses two different open source licenses for Perl.
Okay.
Let's
get it to, just keeping on this hypo, a GPL one and then one that for which they intend to charge more proprietary
stuff. The question is, you go forward as the licensor and you want to sue the licensee because they didn't follow the license. It's up to you to prove which license they didn't follow. It's up to you to say, well, you didn't follow the GPL, and then he'll say, well, I followed the BSD. So you can create problems by dual licensing by not understanding what you're trying to accomplish. I think Lisa's point is understand your business objectives, and we lawyers will craft something for you that'll work.
And one more time, and Larry disagrees with Sun on this, or Sun's lawyers on this, but if you assemble copyrights, if you want to get contributions from outside your organization, that means there are multiple authors. And so your choices are get all of those authors to agree to whatever you plan to do with that code base every time you plan to do something with it, or collect copyright assignments. If you're going to have a dual license, you can't ensure that all the code exists under both licenses unless you collect copyright assignments or require all the contributors to give to both branches, if you know what I'm saying. And the easier way is to do it through copyright assignment because it also makes it possible for you to later defend the code base in a court of law.
I think the Sun's lawyers are wrong, and I think Rehnquist will prove me right someday.
All right.
I understand
that. Lisa, you want to get in on this?
One thing in terms of thinking about the implications of open sourcing, we live in a global world right now. Information ends up in all kinds of different countries. And I've been working in particular with some nonprofits that are looking at international expansion. And both the understanding, the education about copyright in different countries, the cultural sort of understanding of what ownership means and what you can do with it, and also actually the specific rules in different countries on copyright protection vary. And so once you're putting your copyright material out there on an open source, if you're not restricting where it goes, and I don't really think it's feasible to restrict what countries it goes to, I think we're going to be seeing, in the future, we're going to be seeing some complicated international issues around what that material ends up being used for.
I want to pursue this, but Larry, I had one more comment.
I just want to make sure. There are reasons to do a copyright assignment. I'm not saying that there are no valid reasons for it. And the most important reason is that it gives, if you own the copyright, you have standing to enforce it. So that if you are a small developer and you can't afford to enforce the GPL, a good thing to do is to assign the copyright to the Free Software Foundation, and they then will assign their pro bono attorney to defend your copyright, to defend their copyright, because it's been assigned to them. But outside of that, no purpose whatsoever. If you were a company like Sleepy Cat, why would you assign your copyright to anyone? Look, they're going to defend it. They have the right to defend it. And that doesn't mean that Sun can't use their code, the Sleepy Cat code in Sun's product. You don't have to have a copyright assignment to do that. You just have to have a good license.
This is a great and fruitful thing, but let's sideline it. I think it's great to sort of get at areas where we think there's disagreement. But I want to get back to Lisa's point, which is one of the things that we're focused on at the Berkman Center is this notion that both the law and obviously the internet are globalizing in a way that it's already happened, right? How do you help clients, or if you're somebody like Aaron who's providing a license, not technically a client, or Mike as a business person, how do you think about the international-ness of the internet and the release of code? You know, we have trouble enough understanding U.S. law. We have trouble enough understanding these 30-plus licenses. How do you then worry about the EU directives and what they're doing in Singapore? And so how do we even get our head around this idea?
It's a huge challenge. I can tell you that doing business in Europe is not so different from doing the business in the U.S. that you can't hire good legal counsel over there and be okay, and that's going fine. And similarly, Japan in particular and Asia in general. There are parts of the world, I hate to beat the Microsoft drum here, but where copyright, where basically piracy is absolutely rampant. When the question came up earlier, you know, what percentage of people are using your software illegally? Well, pretty much everyone in Korea is using our software illegally. And enforcing our rights overseas and knowing how to do that is a big challenge for any business, particularly for a small business. In some cases, that's a challenge that we are not yet facing because we don't have the resources to reach overseas and do it. In the cases where we do have a business presence and customers overseas, the answer is you have to find people in the geography who can help you out and advise you.
Mm-hmm. So there's one answer here, which is this is a great business model for Baker and McKenzie or Davis Polk or some global law firm that can offer advice in lots of places and lots of friends as sort of local counsel. But that's pretty expensive for developers. Is there any other sort of way to think about it? I think you're right as the practical matter. But
an example with Ashoka, which is a nonprofit that has sort of, they have different entrepreneurship communities all over the world. And basically their response was, we find people we know in the country before we decide what our distribution strategy is going to be, and we make friends with them, and we go and meet with them, and we build a base of people and educate them about what we're doing. And we pay some attention to the rules there, and then we go. And we only go with materials that it won't kill us if they end up being imported back through some other country for free.
Can I make one more point?
Sure.
This kind of, if you're Dudley Do-Right, what should you do? I think that if you're a lone gun and you just want to develop some software, you should seriously consider using one of the very few big licenses that are backed by an organization that actually cares about enforcement. So BSD has University of California, State of California behind it. GPL has the Free Software Foundation. You may not have the resources, the ability to go overseas and defend your rights, but you can believe that those organizations may care, and they may be willing to go do that on your behalf.
Okay, so this actually gets to the next question, which is Professor Moguln at Columbia and others at Free Software Foundation create this great license, GPL, for instance, based presumably in their understanding of United States law, right? And you're now Dudley Do-Right in another country. Presumably there are people here who have used GPL based elsewhere. Is there any concern that it's grounded in understanding of United States law and might then not scale elsewhere as an outbound matter?
No one understands it here.
Fair enough.
Creative Commons has recently announced an international commons project, and the goal is to find people in different countries who know the law there and who understand American law somewhat, and to port our licenses to their local law, so to find the things that need to be changed, to translate them and change them. And so we've just started it. We've got a couple people for different countries. We're looking for more, and we'll see how that works out. You can check our website at creativecommons.org/discuss to see what countries are working on it. You can join a mailing list and help them out if you're interested.
How do you know that these open source licenses are binding and enforceable? Binding in the sense that since generally you have no signature associated with them, has there been any legal test to prove that the distribution of the software itself binds the user to the license?
That's
the MySQL versus NewSphere question, right?
Just as in any kind of sort of shrink wrap or click wrap license, there's mixed case law on whether it's actually enforceable. The trend is towards saying that it is enforceable as long as the license is clear and there are certain steps you take. You know, you'll notice when you go on to sort of different software applications, you have to click to agree a little more often than you used to, and you have to click sometimes on each page to agree. But it's an open question. The trend is towards saying it is enforceable.
Lisa, just to be precise about what you're saying here, you're not talking about the GPL specifically.
No, I'm talking,
you're talking about
the
click-wrap.
Yeah, the fact that you are handing out a license maybe online or through some other way and asking people and not requiring a signature back.
Yeah, the GPL is interesting because it says very clearly you don't have to agree to the license, and this is what makes Sleepy Cat work, is that the only way you can distribute a modified version is by agreeing to the license, and if you don't want to agree to the license, then you can get a secondary license, you can get a different license. You don't have to agree to the GPL. It's not like a click-through license or a shrink-wrap agreement where you're forced to agree to it. It's much more clear because the only way you get those rights is by accepting the license.
So from the abstract of click-wrap licenses down to the specific of the GPL, do we know if it's enforceable?
The question here is, who's it enforceable against? If it is the licensee suing the licensor, then the licensee is going to sue on the basis of the contract, and or what he perceives to be the license contract, and he's going to say, I agreed with it, and the licensor didn't do what he said he was going to do. On the other hand, if the licensor wants to sue the licensee for failing to follow the terms of the contract, then you better get some sort of manifestation of assent. Otherwise, the licensee may not have been bound by the terms of the contract. Now, with respect to the GPL and its beautifully phrased statement, nothing but this license gives you the permission to do the following things. That's true. So the person that's going to be sued, the licensee, is either going to have to say, yes, there's a license, I agreed to it, or I'm willing to follow it, in which case, sue me under the terms of the license, or I never agreed to the license, in which case the court's going to say, well, if you didn't have a license, you must be an infringer.
Is it possible to answer this question with a yes or no? Is the GPL enforceable?
No, it's not possible.
Against whom?
Great. No, I think it's the right thing, but I want to get to a sense that there are instances in which people think it's more enforceable, but there are also instances where people think it's less enforceable, and it's not necessarily a clear and simple question.
I don't see the distinction between having that language in there and not having that language in there as being determinative.
Why is that relevant to Dudley Do Right?
It's not. The answer is so you don't know.
Okay. So this actually brings me back in some ways to Jonathan Zittrain's question, but I see that the big man over here, Charles Nesson, has a question.
Yes, Dudley Do Right here. So I'm listening and I'm trying to figure this out. I have produced a piece of software and I had put it out, GPL, and then I'd confronted the fact that I can't make any money that way. So I'm now licensing it under a proprietary license. But the problem that I've got is that some of the code in my production is actually stuff that I took from other open source developers who had put it out under the GPL. So I'm worried. I'm worried in two directions. I'm worried that somebody's going to sue me for putting out my stuff, which contains their stuff, under a proprietary license. And I'm worried that somebody's going to sue the guy who took it under the proprietary license and say, hey, fella, you may think you got it under a proprietary license, but you got nothing. Is that right? And if that is right, I'm back in the same box I was in before. I can't put this out under a proprietary license, can I?
I wouldn't if I were you, Dudley. I mean, if you don't own what you're trying to license under different licenses, you're making a mistake.
I would rephrase that, not just if you don't own it, but if you don't have a license to do what you're doing.
Sure, fair enough.
You may not have to own it, which is the problem that Denise was talking about.
And if all I've got is the GPL license, I haven't got a license to do that.
That's correct. If you take GPL code from someone else and then combine it with your own stuff, create a derivative work, and ship it out under the GPL, you're fine, because it's GPL, GPL all
the way. I did that.
Okay. But if you then turn around and take stuff that came to you under the GPL and relicense it under a proprietary license, you're violating the terms of the contract under which you received those contributions, and you could be sued by the people who gave you those contributions.
All right, now I have
they
one more question.
They are the only ones who have standing to sue.
I have one more question. Maybe two. Is it the case that the GPL license, nobody's ever tried to enforce it against anybody?
Yes.
That there's never been an enforcement action under the GPL?
It never has to go to court.
People have blinked before. Right. Litigation's been threatened, but one of the two parties has backed away.
All right. So
there's no money.
That's my question. Why is it that there's so little litigation under the GPL? Why is it that this thing exists as the dominating feature of a lot of people's lives, that it's license, it's law, it's lawyers, and there are no lawsuits?
Does it just bug you because he came from MIT and you're a Harvard guy?
Yeah, exactly. But no, really, why? It bugs me. Why is that?
One of the reasons is because of the community. There's really strong community pressure to agree to the license and to adhere to it. And, you know, if you're using open source stuff and the community gets against you, you're not in a very good position.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if someday a company the size of Microsoft says, we don't think the GPL is valid, and we're gonna, and we don't care if Richard Stallman curses us, and or even channels through Aaron and curses that way.
Nothing to lose.
Okay. And there may be legitimate litigation, but if a smaller company faces that, you know, they got a political battle too.
I want to make one very slight amendment to something that was said earlier. You're allowed to combine GPL'd software with other software and ship that. You can ship proprietary apps on top of Linux, for example. That's okay. It's modification and basically distributing a changed work that's not permitted. And exactly where that line is hasn't been litigated. Nobody knows what you're allowed to change. Some stuff most people believe is okay. Some stuff most people believe isn't. But the gray area is pretty wide. As a business guy, so I'm intellectually very interested in the answer to the question, what will happen when the GPL and other open source licenses are litigated? But as a business guy, I really don't want to see it happen. The uncertainty is better for business than a hard answer, because the hard answer might not be the right one.
Okay, so we're at time. I just want to make a couple of moderator prerogative closing comments. One is, there actually has been a lawsuit in which it came to the district court, federal district court in Massachusetts. Judge Patty Saris heard MySQL versus NewSphere and went and sat and listened to this. It didn't make it all the way through to a decision, but it was very clear that the inclination was toward this was an enforceable contract. Exactly how it worked out and whether the obligations carried through, other things haven't been tried out, but it has been sort of, there's an initial foray into the court. But I do think that we've touched on a number of really important things here. One is whether or not clarity is actually a good thing. Mike argues that the lack of understanding, or perhaps the lack of clarity, might be good as a business matter. I think I might take another tack, which is that the clarity could make it better for people moving forward. It might result in fewer legal fees. But I think the main takeaway I've got from today is that to the extent that we care about this new mode of production or existing mode of production and about this community moving forward, we have to get right some of this legal stuff. We have to get a sort of a better understanding and possibly even toward a more standardized way of dealing with it than we have to date. So thank you so much to the panel. You've been excellent.